Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, Chef Norman Van Aken brings us a word on food, and today's arts calendar features Deborah Margol, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. Now, our contributor Judith Bishop speaks with the new executive director of North Miami's contemporary art gem, MoCA.
When longtime curator Bonnie Clearwater announced her departure from the Museum of Contemporary Art, it was big news. And it was quickly followed by more big news, the announcement of her successor, Alex Gartenfeld. Gartenfeld has been described as a whiz kid. Just 1 year out of Columbia, he was the online editor at both Interview Magazine and Art in America. He's organized over 25 exhibitions internationally, with major openings in New York and Rome. Now he brings his cutting-edge vision to MoCA. Located in North Miami, the Museum of Contemporary Art was founded in 1996. It's housed in a 23,000-square-foot building designed by famed architect Charles Gwatney. The mission of MoCA is to showcase contemporary art and to provide fresh insights into its historical context. MoCA's reputation often centers on two words, provocative and innovative. The museum has an impressive permanent collection and presents 8 to 10 special exhibitions every year. They've showcased works by icons of contemporary art, including Roy Lichtenstein, Frank Stella, Robert Rauschenberg, and Keith Haring. Here to talk about the future of MoCA is Alex Gartenfeld, the new executive director and chief curator. Alex Gartenfeld, welcome to Miami and welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. You, as the new head of MoCA, have a very influential position here in the art scene. It's one of our biggest and best museums, and I think people want to know, who is Alex? Where does he come from? How does he think? And what's he going to do for Miami? So let's start at the very, very beginning of your career. Go back to your roots. When did you know that art was going to be your life and your passion?
Sure. Well, I hate to say there was no aha moment, but there really wasn't an aha moment. I didn't grow up around art. I grew up in a cultured family, people who were generally interested in the arts but weren't involved in any significant way in the arts. And then when I went to college, I'd always had a background in writing. I was editor of my school newspaper and really interested in writing. And early on in my college education was writing for a number of magazines. And I went to a school, I went to Columbia University, where it's really hard to do worse than an A-minus because grades are so inflated. It's an Ivy League school. So I was one of these A-minus students. I was just sort of trudging along. And suddenly, my first year, I was a sort of A-minus student. I said, fine. My parents were happy. It was a perfectly okay deal. I started taking art history classes. And suddenly, I was an A-plus student. It was a significant difference. It was everything clicked. Art became the way that I saw the world and the lens through which I started to think about a lot of the issues that I think about every day and that everybody thinks about every day. So there was, as I said, there wasn't really an aha moment, but it was around this time when I was 18 years old, really starting out in college, when I became deeply involved with art.
Well, those A pluses must have paid off because you were in the beginning of your career and still are an overachiever. Your work at Interview and Art in America, two terrific publications, and you were on their online branch. How did that happen? How did you get those jobs and how did you parlay that into curating?
Well, throughout my college education, I was constantly writing. I found a lot of an outlet in magazines. And I started with culture writing, and I moved into specifically into art writing around that time. And that was magazine writing was a real basis for me. Towards the end of my college education, I became involved with researching a project that was very near and dear to my heart, a project called Queer Zines, which is an anthology of artist-made publications, serial publications. I was commissioned by the Printed Matter Book Fair. That publication, it was the first comprehensive book and exhibition that's ever been made on the subject. Still the only one. In fact, it's going into its second edition this month, which is exciting. And that experience parlayed my move into the magazines. And that was a huge project. We put it together in 6 months, what should have been a 5-year long project. So it got me accustomed to really digging in, moving very quickly, taking a really long view at what is really rich subject matter.
Well, you have moved quickly from the online magazine world into criticism and curating. What kind of criticism did you do? Let's start there and then move on to curating.
I must have written hundreds of articles. I couldn't even tell you. That's why exhibition making is so much more important to me, because I can remember every single one of the exhibitions that I made, and probably the articles I couldn't remember in the same way. I created a lot of packages for Art in America. I did a major piece on Simon Fujiwara. That was probably the first, who's a British artist who works with performance and installation and storytelling. And I wrote a major piece about him, timed to his participation in the Venice Biennale. And that was really the first significant piece of writing I'd done. And subsequently, I'd been asked to do a number of catalog essays, which I continue to do as well.
Did you have your eye on the prize, so to speak, of being a curator as your goal, or did it evolve organically?
Well, I came into the magazines and had a lot of friends who are artists, and I worked very closely with artists. Artists were primarily my colleagues. And I felt that I was... there was sort of a gap in my life in terms of what I was doing. And I was living on the Lower East Side in New York on Canal and Allen, which at the time was a really bustling art neighborhood. And there were great galleries there. There still are great galleries there, although the tone has changed slightly. And I was living with, because I had this tiny little horrible apartment where you accessed the bathroom to the kitchen and, you know, everything was wrong that possibly could be wrong. And I had a roommate who was the assistant curator, still is, at the Swiss Institute in New York. And she being an assistant curator, you know, felt a similar lack of ability to do exactly what she wanted to be doing at that time. And so we co-initiated a space together, which was called Three's Company, and we organized four exhibitions in our home. It really came out of working with our colleagues and our direct influences. It was an intergenerational project space, so we worked with some really young artists. We did the first American presentation for Tobias Casper, who's having a major show at the Midway Contemporary this fall. We also did a show with Dan Graham as part of a group exhibition, who's a very established post-minimalist artist who's had major retrospectives at the Whitney Museum. So it really had to do a lot with our personal relationships, and that would happen to be somehow the subject of that project space.
It's a long way psychically from the Lower East Side to South Beach. Did you come to Miami specifically for Miami, or did you come here for a job and say, well, hey, it's a great place to live?
Sure. Well, I came here for MoCA, actually. You know, MoCA does, for a young curator, which I am, MoCA does something that's really unique and really special, and that's creating exhibitions for groundbreaking exhibitions for emerging artists and for underrecognized established artists. And that's something that it also inscribes in its collection, our permanent collection. And that's very rare, actually, because of the way that museums are funded in the United States. They really are only 8 or so of those museums in the United States, whereas you have a lot of these sort of non-collecting parallel institutions in places like Germany where there's tons of government funding for them. There really isn't a lot for an Anglophone curator, an American curator, and they're all in sort of far-off places. So Miami is a great combination of this very unique museum and also a very international place that is incredibly easy for me to move to.
Each curator has a vision. How would you capsulize your vision if you had to put it in just a couple of sentences?
I'm very pragmatic. I would say I'm not an ideologue. So I would say that a lot of the artists who I'm interested in are deeply invested in this idea of critique. So critique has to do with, very simply, making visible things that weren't typically visible. So those could be things like architectural details, or talking about medium or medium specificity. It could be talking about politics. It could be talking about power relations. I would say that unifies a lot of my interests in artists across generations.
Well, we're going to see how your interests and your instincts will affect MoCA in the future in our next segment. Stay with us. We're with Alex Gartenfeld, the new chief curator and executive director of the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami.
Please stay with us. The conversation will continue on South Florida Arts Beat right after these messages. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. We now return to the conversation with our contributor Judith Bishop and the new guiding light of MoCA.
We're back with our guest, Alex Gartenfeld. He is the new executive director and chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art. And he follows a woman who really defined art to some degree in Miami, Bonnie Clearwater. And she had amazing things to say about you during the transition period. And I know that you are also a big fan of hers. But at some point in time, the Bonnie Clearwater curated shows will end and the Alex Gartenfeld ones will begin. How is your vision going to be any different from what Bonnie's was?
Sure. Well, as you said, the foundation that Bonnie Clearwater built at MoCA is really unique, and then we discussed part of that in the last segment, this focus on emerging artists and also underrecognized established artists. Also, this really unique combination of international artists and local artists and putting those people in dialogue. What I can say about myself is that I'm very interested in all these parts of the mission, that part of my curatorial practice, I work very hands-on with artists. So, for instance, we have an exhibition. We have my first exhibition currently on at the museum called Love of Technology. It includes 6 to 8 site-specific projects. Artists who came to Miami were inspired by Miami and the museum and created engaging programs based on that experience. That's something that I do. I have really deep relationships with artists. They are my life and my social life, and I hope to continue to bring artists and art professionals into the Miami ecology in order to put them into dialogue.
Can you paint a visual picture for us about the love of technology? Is it computers? Is it installations?
Sure. Well, I think that it came out of my frustration of a sort of cultural fascination with technology. We presume that technology is a utopia, that it's inherently futuristic, that it's inherently high-tech. There have been a number of exhibitions that have focused on this, have revisited a lot of very 90s ideas about post-human. I was really hoping with this exhibition and through the work of these very varied international artists to think deeper about what technology means and how it reflects on ideas about our body, ideas of identity, and ideas of privacy and public.
We could do an hour on privacy in public and technology. Let's switch gears, though, and let's talk about Art Basel, certainly one of the seminal moments of the Miami art scene every year. What are you doing at MoCA to celebrate Art Basel this year?
This year, it's actually Bonnie Clearwater's last curated exhibition at the museum, and it's a very special one because it's Tracy Emin, who's a well-known British artist. It's her first American solo institutional exhibition. So for that, it's a very signature MoCA event. So we have a big opening for her. It's an exhibition. The floor plan was just established, which is very exciting, all neons. And neons for Bonnie Clearwater, just to speak for her, represent a signal moment in Tracy's artistic development where she was moving from diaristic work into a more abstract phase. So it sort of doubles on this MoCA mission because it's not only an artist deserving of recognition in American context, but also an under-researched area of her production and expertise.
After the Art Basel show, which sounds terrific, what's coming up next at MoCA?
Sure. Well, we have a major exhibition of the work of Wangechi Mutu, which opens in April, which was originally at the National Museum and traveled to the Brooklyn Museum and is opening with us. It's the third stage in the tour. Over the summer, you will see, through our public programs department, an exhibition of Miami-based artists who are working in the realm of performance. In September, we have a solo exhibition, which I've organized, which is the first, actually international institutional exhibition for the New York-based painter Ryan Sullivan. And then at that time, we'll also have performances by another Miami-based artist named Pablo Cano, who's been a recurring feature at MoCA. And then for the next edition of Art Basel, we have the American solo institutional debut for John Miller, who for me has been incredibly influential and crucial figure in the last 20, 30 years of American art production, an artist who's been honored with major exhibitions all over Europe, who's never had an American institutional show for some reason, and whose work, in my opinion, really is deserving of recontextualization. He's also someone who's featured prominently in the last number of years at some of the collections in Miami, like the Rubel Family Collection has. Miami-based listeners of this program might recognize his room of gold-covered ruins in the lobby of that collection.
Usually when art is up for sale, museums compete with each other. But I wonder, to what degree here in Miami do some of the wealthy collectors compete with a museum when you're trying to acquire a piece?
I wouldn't say that there's competition in terms of acquisition. This is very technical, but acquisitions move on a different calendar, and I would say that commercially there's not that much of an overlap. In terms of a curatorial vision, I think it's Miami's so significant because it has this really healthy ecology of both institutions and private collections. I don't see them as competition. I admire the eyes of a number of the collectors in the community, and certainly they push me and push MoCA to do something with a different approach and push us to think differently about our institution so that we're providing a unique and groundbreaking service to the community.
Do you have a wish list or a direction that you want for the acquisitions at MoCA?
No, you know, MoCA has always featured major groundbreaking works, and that's a priority of ours. And that happens both in a local realm and an international realm. It's important that we have a really significant showing by artists. I think also the really unique thing which I'd highlight about our collection is that it really is a collection that tells a story. Most of our acquisitions follow from, or a good part of our acquisitions follow from our exhibition history. And in that, there's tracing a sort of dialogue between the museum and the local community.
How would you describe that story?
That story, I think, is an interesting and complex one, and you can trace a lot of connections between artists like Albert Olin and Rita Ackerman. I think it tells a lot. There's a lot of history there, and I think it's a very cross-continental history. I think it's, as I said, a zigzagging history. I think it's also a history of pushing artists to make major installations, pushing artists beyond their boundaries, pushing artists to do new things, thinking, for instance, about Mark Hanforth's permanent installation in Miami and the push that the commission that MoCA made to Mark Hanforth to make these kinds of groundbreaking next-generation works and to work at a scale that he'd not work at before.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you. A new building has been on the drawing board for, seems like, years, and it stalled and it stalled and it stalled again. What's happening there?
Sure. Well, MoCA is already, in terms of our mission statement and our breadth of programming, too big for the building that we currently have, the exhibition floor plan we currently have. And it's something that we're moving on with a very due consideration and care to make sure that both our permanent collection and our ambitious exhibitions are accounted for in architectural frame. So there is a timetable. It's a long timetable, and it's something that our Board of Trustees and in concert with local officials are working on and thinking very hard about.
How long a timetable?
Long.
Okay, we'll probably have to end on that note. We'll leave the listeners wondering. Alex, it was wonderful to meet you. Good
thank
luck
you.
At MoCA, and we thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
The Museum of Contemporary Art is located at 770 Northeast 125th Street in North Miami. For more information, you can telephone 305-893-6211 or log on to their website, mocanomi.org. That stands for MoCA North Miami. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC, CNBC, and WNET. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will return in just a moment. And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM. That's NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, we'll feature Chef Norman Van Aken. He'll whip up a word on food, and our arts calendar today features Deborah Margol, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. With its mission to preserve America's musical gift to the world, jazz, by offering performances of local, regional, national, and international talent, nurturing the next generation of jazz musicians and fans through educational and performance programs, and encouraging performance opportunities for non-professional musicians to enhance their musical skills, South Florida Jazz has pursued its noble direction for over two decades. Founder, president, and artistic director Dr. Ron Weber, is with us today to talk about this leading force here in South Florida for America's music, jazz. And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. Ron?
Thanks, Ed. I really appreciate having you have me back on the show today.
Well, I hope you're feeling better. Our friend in jazz is recuperating, and we wish you a speedy recovery, Ron. But let's start with, why is jazz the focus of your great efforts in production and preservation?
Well, it's been my life since probably the age of 13, which is too many years ago for me to mention the number. But I was involved in music very early. My parents started me on piano at age 5, and I took classical piano for 8 years. But at about age 11, I sort of gravitated towards drums. And by 13, I was listening to jazz on the radio, and I don't really remember how the introduction occurred, but it went very quickly from Benny Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall concert to Ted Heath, and then next it was, at that time, hard bop and beyond. And I became a jazz drummer, and I've lived and loved this music my entire life, even though I've had it predominantly as an avocation, as I've pursued other things for a living.
Mm-hmm. So as a musician yourself, who got you started? Who thrilled you in the great book of jazz musicians? Was it a Gene Krupa or someone, a Buddy Rich, somebody like that?
Well, initially it was Gene Krupa because he's the first drummer of note, and everybody, no matter who they were at that time, would, if you played drums, they'd say, "Oh, you're going to be another Gene Krupa." It was sort of the drummer of the era, and that was fine. But I never tried to emulate him. I sort of progressed quickly into more modern forms, and one of my early heroes as a teenager was Shelly Manne. And I was mentored by him for a while, and I got to know him quite well through Soupy Sales, interestingly enough. Soupy Sales had a TV show in Detroit where I grew up, and he always had whatever jazz artists were coming through the area on his show. And through a family connection, I got to know Soupy, and I would go down to his show and meet everybody, and I became friendly with Shelly and loved his playing.
Wow!
So I kind of went towards the West Coast jazz in the 50s, and he was probably a great inspiration to me because he was so much different as a drummer than anybody else. He was so musical and had a philosophy about drumming that was purely musical and not so much rhythmic and percussive.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of opened my mind to a different approach to listening to jazz and to drums. So I would say he was a major influence on how I progressed with my own playing and what I expected to hear from others.
Wow, I just don't remember any jazz performers on the Soupy Sales show. I grew up watching that and loving his craziness, but at least it took a seat in my subconsciousness. So moving on, how is South Florida Jazz, your not-for-profit organization, different from the other jazz societies here in our area?
Well, I think the main focus of our programming is the best available and affordable talent in the world, in literally the world.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, we've had artists from 29 different countries perform on our stages. And we have no paid employees. All of our funding, some of it is county and other private contributions from members and very modest foundation or corporate support. All of that money is plowed back into programming. And mm-hmm. the only thing that really has mattered to us is programming and education and trying to perpetuate this music so that the next generation will carry it forth. But my philosophy personally as artistic director is that I have to like it. And if I like it, then I have to think, will the audience like this?
Sure.
But first, it has to resonate with me. I'm the antithesis of a for-profit promoter because I don't really care if the show makes any money. I want it to be the best show available, and I want it to be artists that people down here are not likely to hear otherwise. That mm-hmm. I'm probably going to come to this community, and unless they travel elsewhere, they're not going to see these artists.
Well, year after year. You have brought stellar musicians that normally wouldn't play here in South Florida. So kudos to you, sir. In our limited time left, Ron, I do want to mention southfloridajazz.org is the website to go to answer all of your questions. You can also call 954-462-0222 or 877-311-7469 for any information you might want to know about this 2013 to 2014 season, which started a few weeks ago, November 16th, with the Three Cohen Sextet. They are storming the jazz world, kids from Israel playing great American music. Coming up December 14th, Cyrus Chestnut brings his trio to town with the great guitarist Russell Malone. That's an exciting package.
I think it is. Cyrus Chestnut has that more, or I hate to use the word traditional because I think you know how I feel about the word, but mm-hmm. it's a hard-swinging, gospel-infused sound that just is a very happy sound. And his trio, with the addition of Russell, who I think is one of the most accomplished pure jazz guitarists of this generation, he reminds me so much of Kenny Burrell.
Yeah.
In his sound, I mean, he nothing extraneous, nothing screeching. He's just a pure jazz guitarist with a great time feel and a beautiful sound. So I think it's going to be a terrific mix.
That is a wonderful booking for South Florida. Now, due to the fact that we just have a few minutes left with Dr. Ron Weber, founder, president, and artistic director of South Florida Jazz, will run through the schedule. January 11th, the great saxophonist Kenny Garrett with his quintet. February the 8th, the wonderful bassist Jeff Berlin Trio. Will Calhoun Ensemble on March the 8th. And in April 12th, you're bringing into town one of the new, fairly young jazz piano stars, Brad Meldow, with his trio. That's an exciting booking as well.
Brad is somebody that I was able to book in 1997, and nobody knew who he was at that time. He was in his 20s, and he was obscure, even though he had actually made a couple of records and was playing intermittently with Joshua Redman at the time. But he came in and played solo and knocked me out. And then his career just took off like a meteor.
Yeah.
And I've tried for several years to get him back here, and finally it's going to happen. He'll be here with his trio. I think he's perhaps the number one jazz pianist on the planet right now. I mean, or at least equivalent in some people's minds to Keith Jarrett. I'm really delighted that he's going to be here.
And these concerts take place at the beautiful Mineachi Performing Arts Center, 3100 Ray Ferrero Jr. Boulevard. That's in Davie. And once again, for more information, southfloridajazz.org. And Dr. Ron, we only have just a few more moments left, about 2 minutes, but thanks so much for bringing in the wonderful vocalist Diane Shore. She is such a delight. Her recordings with the Basie Band are superb, and you wrap up your series June 14th with a superb bassist, Christian McBride, with his trio.
Well, Christian was here a couple of years ago with his quintet, the Inside Straight Band, and that's dissolved. But mm-hmm. the rhythm section with Christian Sands and Ulysses Owens is his working band, and they are tremendous. Mm-hmm. So I'm delighted to have Christian back, and he puts on a great show. He's a wonderful showman, and he really makes the audience walk out smiling. So,
and snapping their fingers.
Thrilled. Yeah, really. I'm thrilled about the way the season's shaping up.
It's a great season. Thank you so much for your long years of work bringing stellar international, national, regional, and local jazz stars to South Florida. Many times people we would not see booked here in South Florida. So kudos to you, sir. Once again, our guest today, Dr. Ron Weber, founder, president, and artistic director of South Florida Jazz. More info at southfloridajazz.org. You can also call 954-462-0222 or 877-311-7469 for more info. Dr. Ron, thanks so much for joining us today on South Florida Arts Beat.
Thanks so much for having me, Ed.
Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Ed Bell with you. And now, Chef Norman Van Aken gives us a word on food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the offs and fade, with shafafa on the side.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food is aioli. What do you do with a word like aioli the first time you see it in print? If you don't grow up first in languages containing umlauts, it's confusing for sure. Maybe I resisted learning much more until I started cooking and I discovered how good a word with an umlaut could taste. The first time I made an aioli, I was in Key West, not sunny Provence, from whence she likely shone first. But the sun connected us through the gypsy medium of garlic. I was working at a little restaurant called The Port of Call. There, in the port town of Key West, I was making my first wave of seafood soups, following the recipes of Fernand Point, Escoffier, Carême, and an upstart French-born gent, but now living in America, and doing very well, named Jacques Pepin. The soups had names that included bouillabaisse, cotriade, bourride, and the like. Bouillabaisse actually calls for aioli's cousin, rui, but the bourride and the cotriade were meant to dance with aioli. I bought a cookbook by the great Richard Olney and followed his simple but firm instructions to the letter. That led me to buy my first mortar and pestle. Then I got to work until I mastered that lusty sauce. Aioli is the conjoining of two words, I, meaning garlic, and oli, representing the olive oil. Egg yolks and a splash of lemon juice complete this sauce, along with fresh-squeezed lemon, salt, and a twist or three of pepper. My most cherished experience with the sauce christened aioli came at the home of Lulu Perrot in the town of Bandol in France, also a port town, halfway between Marseille and Toulon. There, at her vineyard home, the famous octogenarian, who was the muse to folks like Richard Olney and the venerated American proprietor of Chez Panisse restaurant in Berkeley, California, Alice Waters. Lulu, as she insisted we call her, served us a simple seafood soup, much like a bouillabaisse, with a small bowl of aioli on the side for each of us. We drank the wines her family made, Domaine Tompier. She sat next to me and flirted, I think. I was temporarily speechless as I beheld the amazing day God was granting me in France, with Lulu and all of us so charmed by her, by Provence. Marcel Boulestan said, "It is not really an exaggeration to say that peace and happiness begin geographically where garlic is used in cooking. If a little garlic makes you happy, aioli will have you on the way to delirious, my friends. And speaking of friends, collect only those who love garlic. Who needs the reproach of those whose senses are uncharged by the magic of garlic?" With aioli, we enter a land that the writer John Lanchester describes as one that evokes a widening of life's sensuous possibilities, the addition of an extra few notes at either end of one's emotional keyboard, a set of new stops on the church organ of the psyche, an expansion of every cell of one's sensory paraphernalia, a new rapprochement between body, mind, and spirit, that land, which is also an idea, a medium, a métier, a program, an education, a philosophy, a cuisine, a word, Provence. Wow, I like a person who gets into it. We cannot deny that Provence is the birthplace of aioli, but it travels well. Bring on the aioli and get in a garlicky good mood. Lulu would want it so. I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Norman Van Aken is the author of My Key West and is also the director of restaurants for the Miami Culinary Institute and Tuyo in downtown Miami. Please tune in tomorrow morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Chicken Fricassee. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat Entertainment Calendar. And today we say hello to Deborah Margol, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. As always, Debbie, great to have you back with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Ed. As always, I am thrilled to be able to share some of the great cultural things that are happening in this town, which is never-ending.
Never-ending, thank goodness.
Absolutely. including tonight, it's the season opener for our very own Dance Now Miami Dance Company. Their program tonight is titled Water's Edge, The Long Walk, and features a dance piece that explores human relationships and the dynamic intersection of land and sea. Hannah Baumgarten and Diego Saltarini, of course, are the directors of Dance Now, and their performance is going to take place at the Little Haiti Cultural Arts Center. Always brilliant work. So if you haven't been to the center yet, there's no longer any excuse not to go. It's just a beautiful place, especially to see dance and to see great work by two of our local most cherished dance choreographers. So that's tonight at the Little Haiti Cultural Arts Center, and tomorrow night. Both concerts are at 8:30. Also tonight, and as it turns out, on Sunday, the final performance is at Miami-Dade County Auditorium as part of the Onstage Black Box Series, a presentation of Hortensia y el Museo de Sueños. This is a very special engagement that is has been ongoing for the last 2 weeks, actually, but the closing performance is tonight. And then a specially added Sunday performance at 2, and tonight's performance at 8:30, the world premiere in Spanish of Hortensia y el Museo de Sueños. This is written and directed by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Nilo Cruz. There are super titles in English, so there's no barrier to understanding and thrilling in this story. It resonates profoundly with many, many locals and many transplants to Miami.
Sure.
Brilliant story, incredible playwright who's, you know, gone on to great success and great fame, but that's tonight at 8:30 and Sunday at 2 p.m. over at Miami-Dade County Auditorium. Also on stage, and this is opening weekend at Gable Stage, of My Name is Asher Lev by Aaron Posner. This is adapted from the famous Chaim Potok novel. This play tells the story of a young student in post-World War II Brooklyn, torn between his Hasidic upbringing and his desperate need to fulfill his artistic promise. Brilliantly directed and on stage over at Gable Stage in Coral Gables, opening this weekend and running through December 22nd. Tomorrow night, Saturday, November 23rd, at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center, is the performance by Tango Fire. This is an unbelievably vibrant, wonderful production being brought to North America, and it features 12 exquisitely skilled dancers, a quartet of musicians, and my favorite, a tango singer, who just has the most sultry way of engaging audiences in tango entertainment. And this is going to be just a beautiful performance down at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center. And again, that's tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center. Also, we are inaugurating a magnificent new Miami Center for Architecture and Design. We are now going to join the ranks of other major American cities who have architecture centers, with the opening by our own local chapter of the American Institute of Architects right here in downtown Miami at 100 Northeast First Avenue. And to celebrate the grand opening of the new center, they are opening with an exhibit titled Drawn from Miami, which explores the city and the development and evolution of our city and its visual built environment by looking at the hand drawings of architects who have contributed to it and shaped it. So this is going to be a wonderful new addition to the cultural landscape. And the center opens officially on December 3rd. But if you go by now, I'm told you can get in and take a look at the exhibit now. So sneak in over. Don't wait. But it's really just a wonderful, we're so proud and so lucky that our AIA local chapter has given us this great new addition to our cultural landscape. We also are in the final weeks of Miami Live Month. This is a great celebration of all live performances cultivated and aggregated by the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau. And the final rundown for this week includes the Miami Reggae Festival at Peacock Park, Los Amigos Invisibles y Carameos de Cianuro at the Grand Central, the Spam All-Stars at Hoy Como Ayer, and a comedy show over at the Fillmore Miami Beach titled Do You Speak Mexican? And shows in some of the other clubs, including Blue Live at the Fountain Blue featuring Adam Lambert, American Airlines featuring Kanye West. I mean, it's just a wonderful lineup of live music, live dance, live theater all over town. So definitely check out Miami Live Month. It has its own website and get the full lineup, but programs end November 30th. And then, of course, the opening of the Perez Art Museum Miami.
Yes.
Here at Miami's Museum Park. If you've been watching it go up, I know it's been mesmerizing for me.
Oh, boy.
But we are just so, so lucky that grand opening is upon us. There's going to be the ribbon cutting on December 4th. And the opening exhibits are nothing short of brilliant and stellar, including Ai Weiwei, Bokra Kalalili, Jed Novat, Yael Bartana, Amelia Pelaez. I mean, you go through the list of inaugural exhibitions, and it really is breathtaking. The building is breathtaking. The new entry into our cultural lives here is unparalleled. And we, too, now will have a modern and contemporary art museum that's dedicated to collecting and exhibiting international art of the 20th and 21st centuries. And hats off to the entire team and to Mr. Perez for his incredible generosity in making the Perez Art Museum Miami really come to life. And, of course, just in time for Art Basel. So the city's about to be wonderfully overrun in all of its manifestations and in every corner. So it's just, you know, we used to dream about having activities as dense and varied as these. And now a lot of people in town, you know, are both delighted and in a way shocked by what happens. But we are about to experience this year's installment of Art Basel. There are activities, as everyone knows, literally all over town. Every museum in town has special Art Basel exhibits. On Miami Beach, of course, at the Convention Center is the main headquarters for the big Expo Art Basel show. There are film nights. There are premier international art shows and satellite shows. Some of those include Art Miami, Aqua 12, Context Art, Design Miami, Ink Miami, Nada, Overture, Pulse, Red Dot, Scope. I mean, it just goes on. And the best way to be able to keep up and participate in all things Art Basel is, of course, to check their website. A lot of people feel like their things are expensive or not available. Not true. There are plenty of free and totally open things to go to. So check out the schedule. Don't miss out. I mean, it's really one of those great events in a community's experience. And we're lucky enough to have it here every year. So if you haven't Baseled yet, check it out. And if you're a veteran Baseler, more power to you. This year's show is going to be better than ever.
Debbie, where do we find more information about these and other events?
Please check out our website. It's miamidadearts.org. That's miamidadearts, all one word, .org.
Great event suggestions from Deborah Margol, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade County Department of Cultural Affairs. Debbie, see you around town.
Absolutely. I'll be out there.
And may I mention these free events, the Italian vocal trio Evolo ushers in the holiday season with American Christmas classics on WLRN-TV Channel 17, December 3rd at 9 p.m., December 7th at 8:30, and other great shows on WLRN-TV Channel 17. Yo Soy, Celia Cruz, the life of salsa icon Celia Cruz, airs on WLRN-TV Channel 17 on Saturday, December 7th at 2 p.m. For more info, go to WLRN-TV. For more info on WLRN-TV, call 305-995-1717. And, of course, you can always go to WLRN.org for more information. Tonight, the Gold Dust Trio, Gold Dust Lounge Trio, plays the Hollywood Beach Band Shell. It's a free show, 7:30 to 9 p.m. at Johnson Street and the Boardwalk in Hollywood. And on Saturday, November 30th, they play Data in Delray at 10 p.m. That's a free show as well. Their new recording hits the streets February of 2014. And the Miami Saxophone Quartet with the University of Miami Frost School of Music Stamps Quintet performs tomorrow, Saturday, from 8 till 11 p.m. at the Hollywood Arts Park, One Young Circle in Hollywood. That's a free concert, all ages. It's presented by the City of Hollywood and Hollywood CRA. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our beautiful website once again at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our online producer. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Judith Bishop, Norman Van Aken, and Deborah Margold. Please call us. We'd like to hear from you, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information to 305-995-2221 or email it to us at info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.